Let's play some cards.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring professional poker player Dennis Phillips and Paul Harrah's.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner!
Wow, winning.
Now, from the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com.
Coming up on the show today, what do American poker players do when they want to play online? They move out of the United States of America. And today we'll talk with Kristen Wilson, who runs a company that helps these poker refugees set up in Canada and Mexico and Panama and Costa Rica. We'll also have the poker coach Joe Tehan joining us on the show today to talk a little bit about people who overthink the game of poker while they're in the game. All that coming up in this hour. Hello, I am Paul Harrah's sitting here in St. Louis while my partner Dennis Phillips is out in Las Vegas after a weekend in Reno, Nevada. Hi, Dennis. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Reno, Nevada. I'll tell you what, there's about a half a dozen casinos up there. I stayed at the Peppermill. It's got a great game going on there, 17 tables and a lot of different events. I was up there earlier for Jennifer Harmon's event that she had this spring.
Yep.
Went back there at the Atlantis. They had a WPT regional one there this weekend that I played in. And probably going to go back there in December for a Heartland poker tour that they have going on up there. Mike Ganey runs the poker room there, does an excellent job, and he really takes care of the players.
Cool. And while you were there, you also played in an event at another casino there, which was a World Poker Tour regional event, right?
Correct. It was a $2,500 buy-in for it. They had about 100 people there. A couple of other notables. Kathy Liebert was up there, and Jennifer Harmon was there. All three of us made it to the final two tables, but unfortunately, I didn't make it to the final table.
Mm.
But it was a good time. Well taken care of over there. Nice, pleasant casino.
I heard you. I heard you had a deep run, but only missed the money by a few.
Correct. About five people from the money is where I was at.
Oh.
So again, another one of those where I outlasted 80% of the field and didn't cash.
Oh.
I've done that a few too many times lately.
Yes, you have. All right. Before we get to our guest later on in the show, we have to talk some more about the fallout from the topic that dominated last week's show, and that, of course, is the Department of Justice, Preet Bharara is the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, and he's the one who came out and said that Full Tilt Poker is not a poker company. It's a, quote, global Ponzi scheme. And a week ago, we heard that they had issued a civil lawsuit naming Ray Bitar, the CEO of Full Tilt, who had already been indicted criminally by the Southern District of New York, DOJ. But he also named Howard Lederer and Chris Ferguson and Rafe First. We talked about this at length on last week's show, a pretty comprehensive discussion. Got some legal analysis from our friend, attorney Josh Schindler. And one of the things that Josh said was, there are going to be more shoes that are going to fall here. There could eventually be a criminal indictment that's currently sealed that will eventually be unsealed. And he said he wouldn't be surprised to hear that the DOJ is going to seize the property of Bitar, Ferguson, Lederer, and First. Well, sure enough, they have done exactly that, issued warrants to seize all the funds that those four people have in various bank accounts. The DOJ has the details on what their bank accounts are, and they've gone after them publicly. We have not heard word one out of Ray Bitar, Howard Lederer, or Chris Ferguson yet. But Rafe First, which, by the way, is a name that most poker players didn't even know was associated with Full Tilt Poker, but he owned 2.6% of the company, according to the DOJ paperwork. Rafe First came out with a post on his blog called The Emergent Fool, and made a statement that wasn't really a statement other than to say, quote, "It sucks to have to endure the character assassination and pot shots being taken at me in the media and social networks without being able to defend myself. Privately, though, I have received incredible support from many of you. I can't tell you how much it means to me, but you never have to endure something like this. But if you do, I hope you have friends as good as mine." And some of his friends, like Bob Bulgaris and Ali Najad, have taken to Twitter and said, you know, Rafe is an honest and trustworthy guy, and they believe in his innocence. Now, we know that there are 19 other people who were owners of whatever small percentages there were of Full Tilt Poker. You mentioned Jennifer Harmon was at this event with you in Reno. I doubt very much that Jennifer had much of a say in anything to do with the company. I would say the same about, you know, Alan Cunningham and some of the others who were probably maybe a 1% owner of the company. But I would also bet that when you saw Jen, she was probably a little bit freaked out.
Absolutely. I don't think Jen has a dishonest bone in her body. I'll just give you my opinion of it. Not anything that I gathered, no inside information, anything like that. In my opinion, probably you nailed it right there. She has a very small percentage of it. She had absolutely nothing to do with the day-to-day operation. She had absolutely nothing to do with the policy making. Being an owner of it, she received her profit sharing or her royalties or whatever you want to call it. She had invested money, and this was a return. It's no different than buying stocks in a company, and then you find out the company's been mismanaged. I doubt that it went anything beyond that. Gus Hansen has just come out in Europe and made a statement very similar to that, saying that he had absolutely no idea. He thought everything was on the up and up. He thought it was a well-run, well-oiled machine that was just, you know, doing incredibly well. And then all of a sudden this happens. So he was blindsided by it. And he states in his that he had money on the account that he can't get back out. I'm quite sure Jen Harmon has money on the account that she can't get back out. So this poor gal is probably looking over her shoulder and afraid to answer the door when it rings, and quite honestly may have done absolutely nothing wrong that you and I wouldn't have done the same thing with.
Yeah. Now,
I feel sorry for her. I don't know what to do.
The question is, who is to blame for all of this? And, you know, there's an expression, this fish stinks from the head down. Do we put all the blame on Ray Bittar? Does he have to share it with Chris Ferguson, who was the majority owner of that, well, not majority, but the plurality owner of this? He had almost 20% of Tiltware. He's the guy who created the software behind this. Howard Lederer, one of the big faces of this, one of the original founders of the company. I think pretty much it's Howard and Chris who started this thing. They eventually brought Ray Bittar in. My question is, if Chris and Howard didn't know what was going on, if they didn't know that their own company was paying out hundreds of millions of dollars, and the number from the DOJ is $440 million went to its owners in dividends over the course of 4 years, from 2007 to 2011. That money was being paid out by somebody at the company who must have known that the company didn't have that money, including the shortfalls from the accounts that were allowed to deposit money without it actually being withdrawn from people's bank accounts and all the rest of that. There was a lot of money that was missing there. Money was being distributed that didn't really exist or should have stayed in those segregated player accounts. And my question is, if Howard and Chris didn't know this, and Ray Bittar is solely responsible, and I have no information that is, I'm just making a hypothetical here, then why wouldn't Howard and Chris get together and say, you know what? Well, this guy, Ray Bittar, is ruining our company. He's ruining our dream. He's ruining, essentially, our retirement, because this was going to be a big moneymaker for the rest of their lives. Why wouldn't they say, something is wrong here. This guy's screwing up our company. We have to get rid of him. And if they didn't do that, then we have to assume that they must have known something was wrong.
Well, I object to the use of a Ponzi scheme. I do not think this is a Ponzi scheme. I don't think any way, shape, or form it is. Do I think there's plenty of blame to go around? Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's no doubt about it. Howard and Chris and all four of these guys that are named there are in deep, deep trouble. They're going to lose their assets. They're going to possibly lose. I mean, they could end up in jail very easily. They screwed up. Who has the majority of the blame? Well, the majority may go to Ray, but you cannot excuse. Even if it was through lack of action, even if it was through just ignoring it, Howard Lederer and Chris Ferguson appeared to be the two guys, all three of those guys actually appear to be the ones that were the decision makers, the ones that sat up there and had the policies come across.
That's the board of directors right there. That's their board of directors.
Exactly. They had to have known this was going on, at least at some level, maybe not the whole scope of it, but irregardless. It's their company. They're on the board. They're to blame. whether, you know, maybe to a lesser degree is about the best you could say, but unfortunately they're in big trouble. The biggest compliment you could give to them right now is what Daniel said, is that they're buffoons who knew no better and just horribly mismanaged it. To me, that's almost a compliment versus what the other things you could be saying they did, that they did it on purpose and it was a Ponzi scheme and all this other stuff. I do not for a moment believe that Chris Ferguson actively and deceived and went into this thing trying to rip people off. I just do not believe that. Do I believe that he mismanaged it? Do I believe that he made some stupid decisions? Do I believe that he's going to have to face the consequences? Yeah, sorry, he's going to have to.
Yeah, I agree with you that the intent wasn't there at the beginning, hey, let's rip off millions of poker players around the world and get rich. I don't think that that was job one for Chris and Howard. But somewhere along the way, they had to have the responsibility to say, hey, you know what? That's what we're doing.
And I'm afraid it's one of the things that just snowballed. They look into it, and they've got $10 million in phantom funds, and it's, oh, gosh, now what do we do? But if we stop it, then, you know, all this other's going to come out. Well, maybe it'll correct itself, or maybe they'll get something. Yeah, you justify things in your mind all the time. But this was just a catastrophic misjudgment and mismanagement. At the very minimum.
All right, let me read
and
you
Let
me read to you a couple of statements. Chris Ferguson's lawyer, Ian Imrich, issued a statement taking issue with the government calling Full Tilt a Ponzi scheme. He says, while the government has obviously taken issue with the underlying activities of Full Tilt Poker, under any reasonable interpretation, the worldwide operations of the online card room are not a so-called Ponzi scheme. Use of that inflammatory term is more than careless and may violate pretrial publicity rules of professional responsibility by the prosecutors. And on Monday, Full Tilt issued its own statement. Here's a company that has not been communicating with the world all that much since Black Friday. They issued a statement to PokerStrategy.com. Quote, Full Tilt Poker is not a Ponzi scheme. While the government has taken issue with the underlying activities, blah, 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 a Ponzi scheme is an investment fraud that involves the payment of purported returns to existing investors from funds contributed by new investors. Ponzi schemes do not involve any legitimate investment, but rather use the new investor funds to pay dividends to the initial investors. Despite recent events, Full Tilt Poker remains committed to identifying a suitable investor and paying back its players in full. Now, we're going to get to the paying back its players part in a second and the suitable investor part in a second. But if you think of what a Ponzi scheme is, it's investors coming in at one end while the people at the other end are siphoning money off. Well, that's what happened here, although the players can't really be called investors because they were at no time buying a portion of Full Tilt Poker or guaranteed any kind of return. But aside from that distinction, this was money coming in one end and people taking it out the other end without protecting the deposits of those people on the first end, right?
Well, again, I'm not going to argue about it being mismanaged. I'm going to argue about them doing it wrong. And looking at it ethically, it was extremely wrong. But is it a Ponzi scheme? No, yeah. I still just don't see it being qualified at all a Ponzi scheme.
I agree, and I that's why I objected to Parit Bharara using that word originally, that phrase. But it got him on the front page of the newspapers, and got Tom Dwan on Fox Business News to comment about this. If you haven't seen Durr doing that, and he's also been posting some answers to questions on some online forums, here's what Durr says about the new amended complaint by the DOJ. I was happy. I think it's good news. Before Black Friday, I liked all those guys, but I'm obviously really unhappy with their actions. To the people making decisions at Tilt, it should be very clear to them that they need to get players repaid or they're going to jail, and the DOJ's amendment did a good job of that. Obviously, I wish I'd known they didn't have all the player deposits. I never would have signed with them. When I signed up, they probably did have all the player deposits, or at least very close. I never wanted to be affiliated with something that runs very much like a bank without the money to cover everyone's deposits. That's just ridiculous. He also thinks that the various owners should give back the money to the players. Quote, they should be saying they'll pay at least this. It would be a step in the right direction. Taxes and processing make it more complicated, but it would still help. Something like this should be done. Now, it's possible there's some very valid reason to not do it, but if there is, I haven't heard it. Most of what I heard is, oh, my lawyer advised me not to, which to me sounds like bull, unquote. That's what Tom Dwan, a Full Tilt Poker patched and sponsored player, but not an owner, had to say about this. Your reaction?
Well, I think he's, for the most part, perfectly right. What else are they going to do? They have the money. They can't cover the shortfall with what's in their accounts right now. So some way or other, that's got to be covered. And will it be a problem? You're darn right it will. Again, pick owner A, whoever it happens to be, and say he was paid out, you know, $20 million over the last couple of years. I guarantee he paid taxes on that and he did everything else. He doesn't have $20 million just sitting in a bank waiting to hand back to the people.
Right.
It's not
right.
quite that easy. But making some sort of a payment back, acknowledging the problems that's there, saying that it might have been mismanaged and we shouldn't have been paying, I mean, something would be nice to hear from other than my attorney says not to say anything.
Yep. And I want to just go back for a second in one of the earlier points. If Chris and Howard know that they were completely out of the loop on this and that Ray Bitar was doing everything about it, I would say to my lawyers, you know, you're telling me to be quiet, but I can't because I have an obligation to the players who trusted me. And I'm going to come forward and say, look, I'm sorry everybody got hurt here. I didn't do it. This guy did it. You know, it's the classic case of every police cop drama on TV. The first guy who speaks is going to get the best deal. I don't know if we're going to actually hear that out of them or if we can hear it out of them. To the point about players getting their money back, the PPA has started talking about this, and they say that this is John Pappas, the executive director of the PPA, says that the people who had money on Full Tilt could be considered federal crime victims, which means, under federal law, they would have the right to full and timely restitution. That's what it says in the U.S. Code. He says that the DOJ should set up a victims fund. He's not sure whether the DOJ actually views poker players on Full Tilt and elsewhere as victims in this. But the PPA suggests that if you were a Full Tilt player and you couldn't get your money off there, you should contact the DOJ's victim coordinator in New York. Her name is Wendy Olson Clancy. You can go to the DOJ's website and find out information about her and contact her and say, look, I want to be treated like a crime victim. I want to get restitution of my lost funds. Pappas says that the PPA is trying to set up a meeting with the DOJ and trying to put language in that if we do license and regulate, or when we license and regulate online poker in this country, that it would require all sites to be forced to A, have enough assets to cover player deposits, and B, have their assets seized if they don't, so that the players could be paid first. And that should be a big priority of legislation when it's written, right?
Oh, absolutely. And again, just to reiterate some of the things that Josh said, the fact that you had a company, PokerStars, that was able to immediately pay back without any restrictions or anything like that, in full, everyone who requested that money, that their accounts were separated and segregated from corporate accounts, that they did do it right, means that other companies can follow that. There is no reason, no excuse not to have that kind of language in any law that's written, because it's a proper thing to do. You need to protect the depositors the same as you do, the same as you would defend the depositors in any bank or any credit union or whatever it happens to be.
Yep.
There is no reason not to. There's no reason not to have it in there, and it's been proven that you can run a company and run it right.
This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show. I'm Paul Harris in St. Louis with my partner Dennis Phillips, who's in Las Vegas. We're covering the follow-up to last week's big story, the Full Tilt, quote, Ponzi scheme claim by the Department of Justice at the Southern District of New York. Full Tilt's attorney says that they may have a deal with an investor. Now, we've heard them saying this for several weeks now, Dennis, but Jeff Ifra, their attorney, says the investors are totally committed to doing this. We've met with them and seen the funds. Their primary concern right now is the AGCC's decision on Full Tilt's license. That's the Alderney Gaming Council in Ireland, which licensed Full Tilt Poker, has suspended it, may decide that they're going to cancel that license forever. If they do that, it's hard for investors to come in and start being Full Tilt Poker again. Ifra says they called and volunteered to discuss their commitment directly with the commissioners at Alderney. Without hesitation, they're prepared to review the terms of their offer. They've hired a prominent and respected lawyer in the gaming industry. They want to set up a meeting with the DOJ to set up issues that Full Tilt has in the U.S., et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they're still trying to get an investor in there, although you and I have talked about this brand possibly being so damaged that they can't get in there. But before we discuss that, I have to say, who is the investor? Well, yesterday, a French website came out and said it could be a guy by the name of Laurent Tapie. Who is he? His father is Bernard Tapie. Who's he? He used to own a French soccer team, the Olympique de Marseille Soccer Club. They won the French Soccer League in 1993. But they were stripped of their title for fixing games. Oh, great! Because we don't have enough trouble. We have a guy who may take over Full Tilt Poker whose father was involved in a cheating scandal? Give me a break here, Dennis.
Well, let me just say this. I don't have dime one on Full Tilt. Never did. So I have no money, no risk, no personal thing like that. The bottom line that I am most concerned about is the players getting their money back.
Yeah.
And if an investor comes in there and he sees enough value from the software and the programs that are a very good program and is a very good software and it has been proven that it works, and he sees enough value in the database, because this is a massive database of poker players all around the world, and he thinks he can salvage this name and by putting new management and everything like that, if this gets the players their money back, he's my best friend all of a sudden.
All right, here's some comments from our listeners on Twitter, our followers on Twitter. I'm online as Paul Harris Show. Dennis is Dennis_Phillips. You can follow us and tweet us there. Mark Karam says this is not a Ponzi scheme by any definition. Frank Means says, thanks, Full Tilt, for basically ruining any chance of legalized online poker in the United States. I don't think that's the case. I think this may exacerbate the chances of legalized online poker. What do you say?
Oh, it absolutely. It shows the pitfalls and everything when a government turns its back and has these gray, questionable laws and no regulation or anything there. They need to step forward. They should have done this years ago, put statutes and regulations in place so that there was no gray area. Everybody knew where they stood, and everybody knew that it was safe to play on a site, that a site was regulated, was governed, and these things couldn't happen. Had they done their job 3 or 4 years ago, we would not be having this discussion today.
Amy Markowski tweeted to us, do you think Eric Seidel has an obligation to withdraw himself from the Poker Hall of Fame based on his criminal fraud? What I haven't heard Eric's name. Eric is one of the owners of Full Tilt Poker, but he's not been charged with anything. So
again, it's the same thing that I talked about with Jennifer. For all we know, Eric had absolutely no knowledge, no information, and no vote in what's been going on at this company. He may have been nothing more than a stockholder. And I'm telling you, that's like if you own a share of Ford and you're upset with the way they ran things, that, you know, you're liable for it. I don't understand how they can draw that conclusion.
I'll tell you one thing. I bet Clooney Gowan is happy she didn't win her lawsuit and end up with a piece of Full Tilt Poker.
She probably could get a good buy on it right now.
While we're speaking about money, Congressman Barney Frank, who a few years ago we saw doing the shuffle up and deal at the main event of the World Series of Poker, and has been out there trying to get legislation passed that would allow online poker. In fact, he wants all online gaming, which we have a problem with ourselves. But if he's going to help get online poker going, that'd be a good thing. He says that he is going to give up any money that was donated to his campaign by Full Tilt insiders. You know that he and other politicians who are pro-online poker probably got tens of thousands of dollars out of Full Tilt and whatever subsidiaries they have, and he says he's going to give that money back because of these accusations against Ferguson and Lederer and First and Bitar.
Well, I've met Barney a number of times. I actually had dinner with him in Washington. We talked over some things. He is an extremely intelligent man.
Yep.
People seem to underrate him when they first see him, or they hear the little lisp in his voice or something like that. This gentleman has got a head on his shoulders, and you should never underrate him. And he also probably looks upon this, that this money that he received could have been some money that in some way, shape, or form may be able to go back to the original depositors, and I applaud what he's doing. He's giving it back without being asked. It's probably the right thing to do.
Yeah, I would say don't give it back yet. Don't give it to the company. Wait. No, seriously.
Yeah.
Wait.
I see what you mean.
Wait until we can figure out a way to get that money to the players. Put it in escrow if you have to, but don't give it back to the company.
Actually, that's a valid point, because you don't know what's going to happen if it's handed back there.
All right. Now, because this story has so many layers to it, how about this one? The Epic Poker League, which we've talked about so much and has already had two events and two big scandals going on around it, or because of two players who were there, the Chino Reams scandal and the Michael DeVita scandal, the guy who was the convicted sex offender who won one of their pro-ams the second time around. That, of course, is run by Annie Duke. Annie is Howard Lederer's sister. Howard was a card-carrying member of the Epic Poker League. Chris Ferguson was offered the chance to become a card-carrying member. Both of them were given the opportunity to become carriers of five-year cards, which is the top of the pile at the Epic Poker League. As far as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong here, Howard signed the league paperwork, but Chris did not, because Chris has really completely stayed out of the spotlight. Is that how you understand it?
That is it exactly. Again, Chris was offered it, never returned any paperwork, never applied for it, never received his card. He is eligible for it. Howard did get his card, but Howard has not played in any events or anything associated with the Epic Poker League whatsoever.
Okay, they have now both been stripped of their five-year cards. So Chris is being told, the card you don't have, you can't have. And Howard is being told, the card you're not going to use, you can't have. I understand that they had to do this for PR reasons, but when they keep talking about the things that affect whether you're a member of the Epic Poker League, this one probably goes above and beyond everything else. But did they have to do it, Dennis?
Well, I don't know. I don't see why they have to do it. They're not going to play down there. It doesn't affect it at all. There's no way in the world that Howard or Chris, either one, are going to show up for any of these Epic things down here. If they did, then you face it, and then you make a decision, and then you move on. But I don't know. Maybe for PR they needed to do it. I know Annie is trying to do everything that's right and proper on this, and she's trying to move poker up to another level. But frankly, this is now the third thing that's come out in the short term that Epic Poker League has existed, and that's just getting to be a bit much.
I think it would have been a no-win situation for her if she doesn't come forward and do this. And by the way, Epic says that she had no vote in this, and neither, by the way, did Andy Block, who's a part of the Standards and Conduct Committee, yep, but recused himself because he's one of the owners of Full Tilt Poker. I think it was a no-win situation. If Epic doesn't do this, people are going to go, oh, sure, because she's Howard's sister and she's the commissioner of the league. And if they do it, then, you know, they catch flack either way.
That's probably true.
Interesting thing I saw online this week, though. Several people on Twitter were saying, how come Dutch Boyd is allowed to play in Epic Poker League events? For those of you who don't know, a decade ago, Dutch Boyd was accused of running a website, an online poker site called PokerSpot, which owes players to this day some $400,000 that Dutch and his brothers and others who were involved in that company allegedly absconded with. Nobody's come to any conclusion about that. But how come he's allowed to play in the league?
Well, you can keep going, too. Unfortunately, there's other people that are on that listing, that 200 people, that have criminal backgrounds. If you don't allow the gentleman that had the conviction back in 1991 and has had a clean record for 20 years to play, how can you allow anyone who has a criminal background to play in that league?
Yep.
I don't want to go naming names, but there's some that do. So I don't know. Where do you stop? It looks like this is also snowballing here.
Yep.
Their conduct committee.
While we're on the subject of Epic, their first TV shot is going to be this Friday. There's going to be a sneak peek of Epic Poker League on Velocity, which is a new channel, which actually right now it's called HD Theater. It's going to become Velocity on October 1st. And they're going to do a sneak preview of the Epic Poker League this Friday night, which is September 30th. The official debut will be next weekend on the 7th on Velocity. And then on the 8th, that block of time that Epic is buying on CBS. And I understand there's going to be a lot of up-close and personal stuff with the players, and they're going to try to make the emphasis on, you know, these are the pros. These are the best players in the world. And hopefully we can get our emphasis off the negative of poker and see poker shown in a positive light. The other thing about Epic is that they announced that the event that they're going to do in February, which I think will be their fourth, because their third is coming up in December, so their fourth would be in February. That's going to be a nine-handed, no-limit game with a 30-second shot clock, something that you have advocated for.
Yes, yes. After talking to Eric Seidel and hearing some of the other players, I don't see any problem with it at all. I think it'll put a little more pressure on the people, but that's happened so seldom. Most people can make a decision in 30 seconds very, very easily.
Yep.
So it'll be interesting to see that. And I don't want to – I got to be careful here because I want nothing more than for Epic Poker League to succeed. I think they have a good idea. I like the idea of upping the scale a little bit and putting poker players on a little higher conduct level. I mean, all the things they have there were good. But, boy, it's not working out so far. So Jeffrey and Annie – prove me wrong, come through this thing, and make it, you know, a shining success. I apologize to both of them 100 times. Let's just hopefully they will succeed.
This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show, brought to you by Harrah's St. Louis, where, Dennis, this weekend I played in the 10K double shootout on Saturday.
Oh, cool.
And got the heads up on my first table and had the guy 24,000 to 6,000, and I lost. On one hand, where I guess it was down, I guess I was up 22-8 on one crucial hand where I turned two pair. We got all the money in, and he hit a card on the river that gave him a bigger two pair. It would have been over at that point. And right from that moment on, I went card dead, and he ended up winning the thing. So I never made it to the final table, and I don't know who actually won the 10K. But they're going to do it again in October. We'll give you a date as we get closer to that. Don't forget, the end of October, the big game is going to be at Harrah's St. Louis. This is not the Poker Stars TV show, but the $25.50 no-limit game with a $10 ante and a $15,000 minimum buy-in. Dennis is going to play in it. If I can get a seat, I'm going to play in it. But we have a lot of interest now. Looks like we're going to have two tables of this, Dennis.
Oh, I think you'll have more than that. I'm getting all sorts of feedback from players coming from all around through the Midwest and even a few of them from the coast that are interested in playing. They're going to see if they can do it. I mean, it could be pretty awesome. There's going to be a lot of action there. It will be the biggest game in St. Louis history,
yep.
Period.
If you're interested, you can email DennisPhillipsPoker@gmail.com, and we'll send you the details. We're going to have people locking up seats for that game probably in a couple of weeks. Other Harrah's news, they're a few weeks away from opening up the new Kelly English Steakhouse, and I think that today or tomorrow they're opening up the new Auntie Anne's Pretzels place there. More places to eat at Harrah's, along with all the great poker action and all the great table games action, plus the slots and the buffet and all the rest. For more information, harrahsstlewis.com is the website. We're happy to have Harrah's St. Louis as the title sponsor of the Final Table Poker Radio Show here on 590 of the Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com. You can get our podcast via iTunes or download them directly from Dennis's website, thechipleader.com.
Kids, are you caught up in that old game of shuffling your debt around and hoping you'll get lucky and win the jackpot? Well, it's time to deal. Mortgage rates are low and savings are high. So stop bluffing and call 800-GRANNY-8 or go to granny8.com. You bet our friendly loan officers make it easy, and we don't have an application fee. So call 800-GRANNY-8 and you'll be holding all the aces.
Great mortgage rates, call 800-GRANNY-8.
granny8.com.
This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show, brought to you by Harrah's St. Louis. I am Paul Harris in St. Louis. My partner, Dennis Phillips, is in Las Vegas. And time now for our Poker Coach segment, brought to you by StackemCoaching.com, a terrific website where you can see the coaches actually working with their students and learn great stuff about poker. You want to get a free trial, you use the code FINALTABLE. That's your promo code, FINALTABLE. And you can get a free trial that way. Today's coach is Joe Tehan, who, before we get into your segment today, Joe, I'm sorry to say I saw you getting knocked out of the main event last week on ESPN.
Oh, yeah, thanks. That was kind of tough to relive it. I haven't even seen it on TV yet, but a lot of people have told me about it and brought back bad memories of the hand, yeah.
The hand was Joe against Brian Devonshire, and it was set over set, and unfortunately, Joe had the underset, and Brian had the overset. And not only that, ended up with quads in the hand. Pretty ugly way to go out. But, you know, you cashed, and you actually had a pretty good series this summer. Four cashes, right?
Yeah, it wasn't bad overall. Four caches, I had a final table that could have gone better, but overall I wasn't too disappointed. I would have loved to have gone deeper in the main event, but, you know, only one person can win it, so.
Yeah, well, congratulations on a good summer. What are you going to talk about in your coaching segment today?
Well, I wanted to talk about just simplifying the game. I've been working with one of our students, Jameson, and we had a session recently the other day. And I really just wanted to, like, focus on just simplifying the game. There was a couple hands that he brought up in his sessions. He was playing 2-5 no limit. And one hand, he 3-bet a guy with ace-king, and he decided to bluff, like, on a queen-7-deuce flop, and then the guy called, and now he bet all in for pretty big on the turn. He ended up losing, like, $400 or $450 in the hand. And then there was another hand where he had ace-king again, and the flop was ace-jack-deuce, and then the turn was a king. And the guy check-raised him on the turn, but the guy only had about $400. And he ended up going all in on the turn, but he really felt like he was beat in that pot. So, you know, those were like two decent examples where he lost the same amount of money in both hands, but he was asking me if there was any way that I can ever consider folding the ace-king on the turn, because when the board was ace-jack-deuce and the turn was a king, he was asking me if there was any way I would consider folding the ace-king on the turn in that hand. And so, you know, at that point, I really wanted to kind of simplify things for him and be like, hey, you just lost $450 in this previous hand where you were drawing dead. The other guy had a set of queens in the other hand, and now he wants to make a hero fold for $400 with top two pair and another pot where, you know, he lost both the pots, but I really just wanted to talk to him. You know, I wanted him to, like, rethink it and just be like, hey, you know, it's a lot of it is my relative hand strength compared to the board. The second ace-king, I told him, you know, sometimes you just got to call and the guy's got to show you a better hand in order for you to lose the pot.
Well, I've been in a situation like that, too, and sometimes, literally, there's just, I don't care what the guy's got. If he's got you beat, he's got you beat. You're not going to lay it down. It's not good poker to lay it down. And in most cases, you have top two pair there. I mean, I'd have to have a heck of a read on the guy, or there's got to be some other compelling reason for me to lay that down. Otherwise, I'm just going to lose my money.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I told him. I mean, you know, normally the guy's only got $400. If he had $1,000 or something like that in front of him, hey, you know, you can think about it or play it differently or whatever. But in that spot, you just got to take your medicine, as they say.
You know, it's funny because we started talking to you about how you got knocked out of the main event set over set. It's kind of the same thing. There are certain hands you're not going to get away from. You're going to lose.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I didn't like the way the action went. I thought there was a good chance that Brian had a set on that hand. But, you know, I had middle set. There's only one hand in the deck that beats me. So if he has it, you know, good luck with my chips. And
Exactly. When you have the second,
I was glad Brian got my chips anyways.
You're probably not
going to have gone to a nicer guy.
Yeah, what were you saying, Dennis?
I said, if you have the second nuts and it's not a game called Omaha, you're probably not laying it down.
Exactly.
That's right. All right, Joe, thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
Sure, thank you.
That's Joe T, and one of the coaches you'll find at StackemCoaching.com for great advice from some of these pros. You can get a free trial by using the promo code FINALTABLE right now at StackemCoaching.com. All right, now time for our guest segment here on the Final Table Poker Radio Show. We have talked quite a bit over the last few months about American poker players who played online for a living being frustrated in this post-Black Friday environment about not being able to do that here in the U.S. and moving overseas. Dennis, you told me recently an astounding number of players who are moving elsewhere.
The report is that I've heard is that around 500 people a week are moving out of the U.S. to a different country to be able to play online.
Well, one of the people who is helping some of those players move is Kristen Wilson. She lives down in Costa Rica. Kristen runs a website and a service called PokerRefugees.com. And so we thought we'd get her on here to talk a little bit about what it's like to move out of the country and be an expatriate playing elsewhere. Hi, Kristen. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
So how many players have left the country? Is this 500 a week number anything close to reality?
I don't know. You guys maybe have better numbers than I do. It's been really hard to establish because as so many people moved in the past few months between when we launched our site and when Black Friday actually happened. So, you know, it's really hard to say, but there's definitely quite a few of them. I mean, in the first 6 weeks that we've been launched, we've had well over 100 people inquire and start to make the move. So it could be much more than that. You know, we may only have a small segment of the market.
Well, what about the legalities of it? I mean, do you have to become a citizen of this country? Can you get an immigration visa? How do you establish yourself and your residency? Does it take more than just getting a post office box? I mean, what steps do you have to take to physically get established to be able then to play online?
Well, that can be classified in different ways. I mean, to get established on PokerStars, for example, which I can say that 100% of our clients move out of the U.S. just so that they can start playing on PokerStars again. There's a list of requirements that need to be fulfilled, such as proving your residence abroad, which may not actually be the same thing as having legal residency in a country. So, and that includes utility bills, a lease, bank account, and having the address consistent in all of the documents that you submit to STARS, submitting them in a specific order, a specific file size, all these other things. Then there's another aspect of actually legally residing in a foreign country, which changes depending on the country and that country's particular laws. Depending on where people go, they might not need to establish a legal long-term residency in such a country because, you know, some countries have flexible immigration policies. Some players only want to spend a couple months in each country and just kind of move around the world. So in that case, there's no real need to establish a permanent residency in those countries. But we have immigration attorneys in each country that can help each client with their specific situation and make recommendations for them.
But in general, Kristen, if a poker player wanted to pick up and move somewhere else and they literally wanted to go tomorrow, I have a passport, I'm a poker player, I'm going to go to someplace else where I can play online, what's the easiest and quickest place they could go to?
Probably Costa Rica, actually. Costa Rica or Panama. Well, all three of our countries. I mean, Canada, Costa Rica, Panama. Canada's a little bit trickier, though, because the Canadian government doesn't really look highly upon poker players moving there because they assume that it would be permanently. So in that case, you know, sometimes we recommend that people get, well, I don't recommend, but I put them in contact with professionals who work in that, you know, segment who can recommend whether to get a work permit or a study permit or something like that. But literally, like this week on Sunday, I had some guys post on the wall that, hey, Kristen, we're coming to Costa Rica. And I called them and their phones all went to voicemail. And I emailed them and they immediately called back and they're like, hi, we're already here. And that was 10 o'clock on Sunday night. And so I essentially didn't sleep and just did everything I could overnight so that Monday, you know, I could help them find a place to live and just get everything settled.
Wow.
Some people can literally come tomorrow and I will be here and I can help them. But I ask that everybody give me, you know, some time to plan because it's complex. I mean, granted, we are facilitating it and making it easy for people to leave America, but it's still a lot of work and at least for me.
So the guys that arrive there on Sunday, how soon can they actually expect to be able to play online? I mean, is this a couple of days? Is this a couple of weeks? Does it take a month?
The part that takes the longest is finding a place to live. And for my clients that sign up before they get here, we can get cover a lot of ground before they get here. You look at properties online. I can explain the different areas. Some people aren't sure if they want to go to Thailand or Argentina or Costa Rica. So, you know, just explaining people's options to them and then just going step by step, breaking it down and getting to the point where some of my clients actually reserve an apartment or a house before they get here. So in that case, I can get, you know, their utility bills, their lease, everything can be set up before they get here. So they might not even need to stay one night in a hotel. And in that case, they can submit, you know, submit their documents within 24 hours of getting here. And it just depends on how fast STARS approves them.
So is that a matter of just a few days after that, or are they going to have to sit around in their new apartment for 4 to 6 weeks while they're waiting?
No, I mean, the average time that it takes, and I think it depends on the person, and I'm sure that STARS has their own internal policies regarding this, but I mean, a week or less. If you submit everything in the correct format and your documentation is complete and it's credible and, you know, they can tell that it's real, then it can take a week or less.
Wow, is right.
So these guys, for example, they're renting a house, but the house they want isn't ready until later. So we've decided to rent an apartment instead just so that they can, you know, get their leases, get their bank accounts and everything. So it's taking a little bit longer, but they also gave me like 5 minutes of advance notice. It's okay, though. We're having fun here.
Is there a destination of choice? I mean, is it Panama that the majority are going to, or is it kind of split up among half a dozen countries?
I would say really most people are going to Costa Rica.
Okay.
And
that's because winter is coming.
Costa Rica is just a great place to live in general. So, you know, whether you're a retired baby boomer from the U.S. or a poker player, like, it just works.
If there's changes within the U.S. in 6 months, in a year, in 2 years, whatever, how easy will it be for these players to return to the U.S.? Or will they run into complications there?
I mean, that's the great thing about being a U.S. citizen is we can always go back. I mean, I'm going back. I just bought a ticket literally today because I need to go to the U.S. on Thursday. So I just bought a plane ticket this morning, and I'm going to go. And I feel like that. Like, you know, I don't feel like necessarily I'm committed to any particular country. Like, I like to travel around just as much as a lot of the poker players that are, you know, touring around the world. Granted, I don't travel that much, but, you know, we can always go back to the U.S. It's just a flight away, and for the most part, only a few hours in a plane. And these guys pack really light, so they have, you know, a suitcase and a laptop and maybe a monitor that's inside of their suitcase. So they can always move if they feel so compelled to do so, and if regulation changes in the U.S. So that's what we're doing, is we're facilitating it and making it easy for people to move out of the U.S. But I think that they'll find that when it comes time to go back, probably not much will have changed in America.
Yeah, they're not giving up their American citizenship. They're just playing overseas. I'm curious, though, you know, if they move to Canada, English is not going to be a problem. Unless they move to Montreal, they might have to run into people who only speak French, but that's unlikely. But what about somebody who moves to a Latin American country and they don't speak Spanish? How much of a problem is that?
Well, it depends on the country because, for example, we chose Costa Rica and Panama because they're really American-friendly countries. There's a lot of foreign investment, a lot of international tourism, and a lot of U.S. citizens that, you know, that Panama had the canal zone for many years, so they're used to seeing Americans, and a lot of people speak English there as well as Costa Rica. Now, depending on where you go within those countries, there's probably going to be less English than other places, but for the most part, the people that work with my clients in Costa Rica and Panama, like, I try to find taxi drivers that speak English, I don't know, just, you know, just people that you would want to come into contact with, attorneys, accountants. A lot of people speak English here because of all of the tourism. So it's not as much of an issue as one might think, let's say, compared to moving to Peru or, I don't know, some country that's not as popular on the map. But in Costa Rica and Panama, you'll probably end up running into a lot of not just poker players, but international expats that are just cruising through the country. So,
yeah, Dennis, you've had experience playing poker in Latin America. Was the language a barrier for you?
It actually wasn't that much. When almost everywhere we went, there were some people around there that could speak English, or at least a smattering of it, and ways to interpret it. And people, you know, they obviously recognized you as an American, and they were willing to help. I've been down to Latin America 8 or 9 times now and never really have run into any problems. But to come back to the point here,
I think the guys like that the girls don't speak English also.
But I'm very curious. You mean literally, I could move to Costa Rica. I could stay in Costa Rica for 3 years. I could travel from Costa Rica to other places in Latin America, to Europe, to whatever, without any problem. And then the day that they would change something in the U.S., I could move back to the U.S. after that long of a period. And Costa Rica has no problem with that?
No. There's no problem with that. I mean, if you are on a tourist visa in Costa Rica, you need to leave every 3 months to renew the visa. And there is a chance that maybe if you came in and out so many times, eventually they would start questioning, like, are you living here or are you just traveling here? But for the most part, if you have, let's say, a home base in Costa Rica, and then you decide you just want to move around and travel the world, they won't care. You know, you can just come back, because U.S. citizens get an automatic tourist visa unless they're flagged in the system for some reason. And as far as I know, you can stay outside of the U.S. for as long as you want without giving up your citizenship.
Yeah.
So Ray Bittar
might get
flagged.
So you can literally just go in and out.
Yes, I think Ray Bittar might get flagged for that. But everybody else is welcome down there. Especially since...
I mean, let's say also, like, these guys, a lot of them have girlfriends and family members in the States. So they might go back really frequently to the States from here, because it's cheap to fly in and out, and I guess for the money they make, they don't mind doing it.
All right, Kristen. Well, we really appreciate the information. Give the website or some contact info so some of our listeners who are interested in going there can get in touch with you in case they want to become poker refugees.
Yeah, you can just go to the Pocket Fives website, and it's just pocketfives.com/poker-refugees. My email address is pokerrefugees@pocketfives.com, and there's a lot of really clear links on the Pocket Fives site that people can navigate.
All right, cool. We appreciate your time very much. Thanks, Kristen.
You're welcome.
That's Kristen Wilson from Poker Refugees, helping Americans play poker online overseas until such time as they're allowed back in the U.S. to play it legally here, which we hope will just be a couple of years. Dennis, before we go, you're actually leaving the U.S. to go play poker, but not to Costa Rica or Canada or Panama. You're headed to the U.K., right?
Yes, we are. We're heading over to London. We're going to play in the EPT over there with Poker Stars at their invitation, and then going down to Cannes to play in the WSOP Europe. We're going to spend a couple of days in Paris and then come back and stop by Hammond, Indiana. Jason Newman, the director of poker up there, has got the circuit event going, and it's always an awesome time. So we're going to be leaving and totally gone, 3.5 weeks.
Great. Well, I'm going to be up in Hammond, so maybe our paths will cross up there. I think I'm going the first week, and I think you'll still be in Europe at that time, but maybe our paths will cross there. We'll certainly be together here in St. Louis for the big game at the end of October. One thing I have to warn you about the WSOPE, somebody online was asking Jack Effel if it's true that the cash games there have no cap on their rake, and Jack replied, it's 2%. It's 2% in PLO and 4% in hold'em games, and yes, there's no cap. 4% uncapped. If you're playing a big cash game, that could mean a lot of money out of your pocket. That means you better have some fish at the table who are big donators to make up the difference.
Oh, there's no way that can be a positive EV value on that, Dan. If you're raking 4% of it every time, you can't be a winner. 90% of the people have to be losers.
Well, you'll have to let us know when you come back from there.
Okay.
All right, have a great trip. He's Dennis Phillips, today in Las Vegas, tomorrow in London. And I'm Paul Harris. We'll meet again here next week at Harrah's St. Louis for another round of the final table. Tuesdays at 3 on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com. And don't forget about our podcast. You can download all 139 shows anytime you want by going to thechipleader.com, where there's a list of all of our previous guests, so you can pick and choose which shows you listen to that way, or you can just subscribe and get them all via iTunes. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show.